If you weren't here yesterday, we began by looking at the home from the perspective of the marriage relationship. Husbands and wives, from the beginning, God's plan for men and women and what marriage ought to look like. Going into a lesson from Ephesians chapter 5 in the next session and talking about the ideal of that relationship. And then looking at the example of Hosea as an example of love, of God's love towards us that we ought to imitate in the home. I want to begin looking at the parent-child relationship this evening, and we'll talk about that tonight and tomorrow night and then again on Wednesday night, and particularly how God's Word instructs us and guides us in raising our children. And tonight we'll begin by looking at the example of the parents of Moses. It is striking, the story of Moses' birth and being raised. It's striking enough that it grabs even the world's attention. It's just a good story. I mean, even without all of the religious implications, it's just an exciting story. But for us, it's more than just a story. It's a story of faith. And what I want to do this evening is focus on the faith of Moses' parents and see what lessons we can learn from that. In Exodus chapter 2, and beginning in verse 1, it says, "There was a man from the house of Levi, and he went and married a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could not hide, or when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it with tar and pitch. And she put the child into it and set it among the reeds on the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid. And she brought it to her. When she opened it, she saw the child. And behold, the boy was crying. And she had pity on him and said, 'This is one of the Hebrews' children.' Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, 'Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you?' Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Go ahead.' So the girl went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages.' So the woman took the child and nursed him. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she named him Moses, and said, 'Because I drew him out of the water.'" I'll tell you, the first thing that's interesting to us about Moses' parents is that their names aren't mentioned here. They are mentioned elsewhere, and we'll get to that in just a moment, but they're not mentioned here. What's more is that when we go over to the book of Hebrews chapter 11 and this story is brought to our remembrance for the purposes of illustrating faith, in Hebrews chapter 11 and in verse 23, "By faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months." Now, just stop right there. Whose faith is being spoken about in Hebrews 11, 23? It's going to get to Moses' faith, but of course, as a three-month-old, Moses' faith is not what's under consideration there. And so by faith, Moses, well, of course, his parents, when he was born, hid him for 3 months. He was hidden by his parents, it says, because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. And so even as the Hebrew writer is pointing backward and bringing this story up again, he doesn't mention the names of Moses' parents. Now, Amram and Jochebed are mentioned as we look through the genealogies, and so we do know what their names are, and it's not that I think God wants to hide that from history, but I do think as we're looking at the story, the narrative as it's being told, and even by way of remembrance we're being given that narrative in Hebrews 11, what it suggests is that Moses is the key figure here, right? Moses is the one that we're focusing on. And I'll suggest to you, as far as Moses is concerned, you are hard-pressed to find a more prominent, a more exalted character in the Old Testament. As we go through the book of Genesis, we've got this narrative that covers hundreds and hundreds of years of history, and then we slow down. And right here, we really slow down. Now we'll kind of blow through the first 40 years here of Moses' life in the period when he's being raised. We'll blow through another 40 years as he goes away from Egypt. But then we're going to spend from Exodus chapter 3 all the way to the end of the book of Deuteronomy, and Moses is the guy. I mean, he is the key figure. So, as it's telling the story, God focuses on what he wants to focus on. He focuses our attention on who he wants us to focus it on. But the Hebrew writer says the parents had faith. And I want to contemplate that faith from the standpoint of what they did, the environment they did it in, what kind of strength and courage it took for them to do it, and how that we can draw lessons from that. And so that's what I want to focus our attention on this evening as we look at that text and we think about the history that's surrounding this, I think a familiar history to us. And so the first thing that I want to consider is this. What kind of faith does it take for Amram and Jochebed to have a child in the environment that they have a child in? Have you ever heard someone say, why would you even want to bring a child into this world that we live in now? I hear that. I hear that especially more and more from young people. And of course, there's a lot of pressures, there's a lot of reasons why people are giving to not want to bring children into this world. And some of that is external, some of that's because of the chaos that seems to be around us in the world. Some of that's really just a matter of inconvenience. And let me just say, you know, a lot of people, they'll come in and say, why would you want to have children? Because it seems to me life would be a lot easier if we didn't have children. And I have children here tonight who, you know, I don't want to offend my own children, but life is easier when you don't have children. I mean, frankly, it's less complicated, right? And so when you have children, what do you have to do to have children? Well, first of all, you have to go through, one of us has to go through, a very painful process. And that painful process, in fact, as you go on in the scriptures, comes to be a simile, a metaphor for pain. Like when God says, judgment is coming, he often says, it's going to be like birth pains. Right? So that's how it starts. That's how we introduce children into the world, is intense pain. And so we bring them into the world. And then what happens? Well, I don't know about you, but when we were going to have children, I get this question now and I chuckle, but I remember asking people when we were going to have children, what's it going to be like? What's going to change? And they're like, ha! Everything, right? Nothing will be the same. They're like, yeah, everybody says that, but what do you mean? I mean nothing. Like your whole life, it's not your life anymore. Your schedule's not your own. You think you have arrived on time for the last time in your life, right? So from now on, you don't get to decide. The baby decides to spit up on the way to that gospel meeting that you thought you were leaving in plenty of time to get there. Sorry. She had other plans. Or you think about what it takes to even get somewhere. I could not believe the amount of stuff that goes along with this little thing. And you have to get a whole new vehicle just to fit it in. It's inconvenient. And you go through the sleep deprivation. That's the biggest thing. Like at every point in your life till you have kids, you can get to a point where you just put things off. You can tell people from work, I'll call you later. Whatever problems are going on, you say, I will worry about that tomorrow. Children, they will not listen to that. They come along and they cry and they will not stop. And you just, you don't have any other choice. And so you go through all that process and you go through that sleep deprivation and you come out of that stupor. And what do? You go, you know, I think we'd like to do that again. And you have something, and I believe it's God created, that makes you want to have these children. And so you push past all of those conveniences, and I believe that there is something, as you're looking at that, there's something of faith that keeps you saying, I want this. One of the reasons I think we need to do that is because God says, this is good. It's a good thing. And it's a blessing to have children. I think we need to be talking about that more and more frequently. We need to look at what the psalmist says in Psalm 127 and verse 3 and how he talks about the blessing of children. That desire of having a quiver full of children, but having a house full of children, and that is a good thing. I know it's easy for us to forget it for a lot of reasons. Have you ever had that experience? You're going through the grocery store and you've got one child that you're just trying to keep from falling out and cracking her head because she just seems bent on harming herself. And the other one, every 3 seconds, you're taking something back out of the cart and you're putting it on the shelf and you're trying to do all of this without getting in trouble with the DHR. And the little old lady comes down the aisle and she gets this big grin. And she says, "Enjoy it while it lasts." And you go, "Enjoy it? What do you mean?" And now I know what she means. I don't even know it as much as I will, but I know already how much I'd like to rewind. How much I'd like to go back. I mean, we're at that point where, you know, we're reaching milestones and they make my wife cry, every single one of them that we hit. And you're just constantly wishing, "I wish we could go back." And I want to say to those little old ladies, sometimes they get some flack for saying that. Don't quit saying that. Keep reminding young people that it is a joy, that it is a blessing to have children. And I believe that Amram and Jochebed must have believed that. They must have believed that it was a joy to have children. Moses is not the first. And what environment did they bring Moses into? You think that we have chaos? You think that politics is in an uproar? You think that there are wars and there are difficulties? They are slaves. And not only are they slaves, but they bring Moses into the world at a time when Pharaoh has said, "Every male child that comes into the world, I want you to drown him." Now he makes provisions for other people to do it, but he puts the command on the parents themselves. I cannot imagine. I suppose there were some Israelites, I don't know for sure, I suppose there were some Israelites who complied with this. There are certainly Israelites who followed after the idolatry of Egypt and who conformed at least to some degree. We see that as their history goes on. Joshua would refer back to the serving of the idols that they did. But Amram and Jochebed are not among those. And so here is this environment, and by all rights, you would think they would look and say, "This is not the time to have children." But they go ahead and they have those children. I think we need to be talking about not only children, but we need to be talking it up in such a way as to refer to it as the glory and the blessing it is, and especially for motherhood. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 15 is an interesting passage, and I don't know that I understand all of the implications of what Paul is saying here. I have some thoughts about it that we won't get into tonight. But just take it at face value. It says, with regards to woman, "Woman will be preserved through the bearing of children if they continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint." Now, obviously, I don't think that that means that the only way a woman's going to be saved is she has children, obviously. But I tell you, even if it doesn't mean that, and I know it doesn't mean that, it does seem to indicate that with regards to womankind, that this is a peculiar and special blessing that is for her and her alone. And it has been relegated, and of course we have so much chaos in our society where we don't even know what gender to call people anymore, and they say they're men having babies. Now there are women who call themselves men who are having babies. But this is a peculiar thing, and it's meant to be exalted, and our world has lowered the estimation of motherhood. It has lowered the estimation of raising children at home. We have some members, some young people at Pepper Road who became Christians in college. And their parents, especially her parents, are not only not Christians, they're not religious in any way. And she doesn't know what to tell her mother because she's decided to be a stay-at-home mom. And she just got this chemical engineering degree. And she knows the kind of blowback she's going to get because the world thinks she's nuts to have come out of college with this expensive education and then to go home and raise children. And God says, oh, you got it upside down. Here is a glory. And we need to talk about it that way. In the Bible, as you go through, you see the way that women react when they're not able to have children. I don't want to heap shame on somebody who's not able to have children. Don't get me wrong. But I do want to appreciate that there was sorrow that went along with that. That when Hannah comes and prays before God at the beginning of 1 Samuel, and she is praying for a child, it is sorrow that she's pouring out to God. It is sorrow that Sarah's bitterness that Sarah has when she's not able to have a child. She is barren. When we get to the New Testament and we have Elizabeth and Zacharias, and it tells us as we go through the story that they had been praying to God. Why? Because they felt the sadness, they felt the emptiness, that lack of fulfillment. You might say, well, look, Stephen, there's people in the audience tonight who can't have children, and what are you saying? I'm saying I am sorry. Because I know I've got loved ones who are in the position that they cannot have children, and I grieve with them. The solution is not to act like it's not a problem. The solution is not to say, well, having children is not a big deal anyway. That is not the answer. We need to keep talking about what a blessing it is. And somebody says, well, you make me feel sad. Well, I mean, I'm sure I make people feel sad when I talk about being able to pick up the phone and call my granddad because they can't do that anymore. I get that. The solution is not to talk about how it's not a big deal to have a granddad. And so we want to continue to talk about childbearing like God's Word, to talk about motherhood like God's Word talks about that. In the slavery that they were brought into, in the religious situation that they were brought into, the idolatry, under the death penalty, they brought Moses into all that, and I want to suggest something else about their faith. I believe that they did that with a faith in God, that they would not, it said they did not fear the commandment of Pharaoh. And as we'll go along in the lesson, we'll see that they brought him up in a godly way. They brought him up with faith in God. And so I believe they had confidence that that was a possibility. So this is something that I hear sometimes. It's like, how could you possibly bring a soul into this world knowing the odds are against them? Well, it's because I don't think the odds are against them. In Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6, this passage that was referenced, train up a child in the way he should go, and even when he is old, he will not depart from it. I know that that's a proverb. And I know that somebody might come up and say, well, listen now, I know some people who were godly people and did the best they could, and when their children were old, they did depart from it. Okay, I know that's possible. And that there are exceptions to the Proverbs. That's the nature of a proverb. A proverb is a general truth. But I'll tell you what it is saying. The odds are with you. You do this, and the odds are with you. This is the general truth. This is what is typically going to happen when you raise your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. You train them up in the way they should go. So, I come to God's Word with that confidence. Not with arrogance, I hope with humility, and especially if you have killed children, you better have some humility. And I hope that I understand that there's a difficult path ahead, but I also hope that we come in knowing it's possible. It's like when people go into a marriage and they say, well, I hope this works out. No! What do you mean you hope it works out? I hope you've already decided how that's going to work out. And so people come along with their children and they say, well, I hope God gives me faithful children. We're going to talk about that a little bit more. You don't sit back and hope it happens. You go in with the confidence that you're going to raise them as God has guided you and directed you. We're going to talk more about that, of course, the specifics about that as we get into Proverbs tomorrow night. And of course, we understand, we need to understand that the greatest joy that comes from having children is what John says of his figurative children in 3 John and verse 4. I have no greater joy. That's where we got to start. We're bringing in children. We say, my greatest joy, my highest joy in my children is going to be faithfulness to God. And we put that above everything else. Well, going back to that scene in Exodus chapter 2 when Jochebed and Amram bring Moses into the world, they had enough faith to protect Moses. It says over in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 23 that they did not fear Pharaoh's edict. I think that when you bring children into the world, you can obviously do so without faith, without any intentionality, right? My brother and his wife are foster parents. And so I see quite a bit of children brought into the world without intentionality. No purpose whatsoever. No desire to protect. In fact, what we see a lot of is mothers who are so careless of the children they're bringing into the world that they continue to inject themselves with drugs and alcohol, and the children come in addicted to those substances at birth. So, like, just birthing a child is not in and of itself an act of faith, but doing so intentionally is an act of faith. And doing so with a protective mindset certainly requires some faith. It is not possible to raise your children in godliness in the way that they should go without faith. It's possible to bring them into the world and raise them just any old way, but it's not possible to do so with intention without faith. And too many people bring children into the world with no intentions about what to do with them once they get here. No intentions about what to do with them once they get past the baby doll stage. Lots of women want a little doll to hold, but then they don't want any responsibility after that, and you see them begin to both parents begin to abdicate that responsibility as the children get older. I want to notice something about the protection and the willingness to defy Pharaoh. Over in Hebrews 11, there in verse 23. Again, notice what it says, and it says the same thing in Exodus chapter 2 and verse 2. Hebrews 11, 23, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child. Exodus chapter 2 and in verse 2 tells us something very similar. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. We find over in Acts chapter 7 in verse 20, once again, as Stephen is calling this sermon, this occasion to remembrance in his sermon to the Jews there. In Acts chapter 7 and in verse 20, he says, it was at that time Moses was born, and he was lovely in the sight of God. And he was nurtured 3 months in his father's home. Now, if you read that, if you read Exodus chapter 2 especially and Hebrews chapter 11, it might look like this. It might look like when they saw what Moses looked like, then they decided to do this. So, you know, maybe the plan was, we're going to drown this baby if it's a boy, especially if he looks like Aaron. But he got here and it's like, oh, well, now we can't drown. This is a beautiful baby. And we just can't harm him. Now, of course, that's not what's going on here. But how do you reconcile that? That the reasoning given is that he was lovely. Well, I think part of the way we reconcile that is in Acts chapter 7 and verse 20. What Stephen said is he was lovely in the eyes of God, or in the sight of God. Now, that word lovely is the same word as beautiful in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 23, and it's the only two places that word is found in the New Testament. So don't get a lot of help there. But when we go back to Exodus chapter 2 and verse 2, the word for beautiful there, that they saw that he was beautiful, And so she hid him for 3 months. That word is the same word that's all throughout the Genesis 1 creation account. And it's the word that's used in the phrase that the Lord saw that it was good. And so when he created the earth, he saw that it was good. And he says that over and over and over. Now, I do think this. I do think that there is some power in seeing a life. I think there's some power in seeing a newborn child. I hope that any of you who have ever been in the room when a child has come into the world were not unaffected. If you were, that's difficult. I don't understand that. You ought to be affected by that. I have a friend who is a Christian because he was an atheist when he went into the hospital room with his wife to bring their first child into the world. After his first child came out, he was no longer an atheist. And today he's a Christian. Why? How do you look at that and say, there is no God? There's power in seeing life come into the world. And so I don't know. I don't know what plans they had before this. I'm not saying that they had planned to destroy Moses, but I think there's something to noticing that they looked and they allowed themselves to be affected and to appreciate the beauty of life. And we are surrounded by a world who less and less appreciates that beauty. But I want to suggest to you they appreciate it more than you know. Because when states want to pass laws that say when a woman is going in to slaughter her own baby, that they're going to require these women to look at an ultrasound. Just look at it. They can still go ahead and kill their baby, but they've at least got to look at an ultrasound. And the people are saying, no. Why? Because they know. They know what the power of seeing that image is. It's what's turning public opinion with regards to abortion issues. I mean, the people making the laws are not changing their minds, but the general populace, they're seeing what that looks like, and they can't just keep saying the things they've been saying. They can't say it's nothing but a tumor. No, that's a baby. And it affects you when you see that. And so I think they are affected, and I think it speaks to that. And I think it also speaks to seeing potential. Seeing potential in life. Potential is not the strongest argument. It's not the only argument, and I don't think it's the strongest argument against abortion, but it is still a powerful argument. To say you don't know what it is you're destroying there. You have no idea what accomplishments you are robbing the world of. There's a famous story of a teacher in an ethics class, and he asks the question of the students, what would you do in this situation? You've got two parents and they're about to have a child. They've already had several children who have died in birth or shortly after birth. Both of the parents have various diseases. Some of their children have defects, they have blindness, they have deafness, and now they're about to have their seventh or eighth child. What do you recommend? And to a person, they said, abort. He says, congratulations, you've robbed the world of Beethoven. You have no idea what you're robbing this world of. But can I go a step further? I think that people have no idea what they're robbing the world of when they think they are sure there is no potential. Because they go in and they see a disease of some sort. They see that there's cerebral palsy in the offing. They see that there's Down syndrome. And they go, well, now surely you can see that there's not potential there. Well, look, I've had a nephew with cerebral palsy. And I know what potential is there for joy and in the lives of all the people that surrounded him, for sorrow as well when we had to bury him. And so it is great. And these people are so arrogant that they think they can calculate the potential. You cannot. And so here are parents who look at their child and they say, this is beautiful. And parents, we're going to have to instruct our children, because what used to be natural is being educated out of our children. They used to know how to look. You know, it used to be instinctive. Like in the animal kingdom, you look at your baby and obviously you see beauty and potential. But mothers are being taught instead to look at their children as merely choices, some option to be weighed out against the pleasures and conveniences of life. You talk about inconvenience. Well, they were willing, because of what they saw, to protect Moses. I know that we are not bringing children into this world under the death penalty. There are people in the world who have. I know a woman who was born into this world because her grandfather in China went to her mother and pleaded with her not to go and get an abortion when the ruling authority said she had to because they'd already had one child. And she is alive today because her grandfather was able to persuade her mother to stop and don't cross the river and don't go and abort this child. And so there are people who still are having to make that kind of decision, but we're not. We're not. But I'll tell you what, we've got just as many concerns, and our concerns are eternal as far as what we need to be protecting our children from. And when we bring our children into this world, we are no better than the person who aborts their child than if we are one who aborts our responsibility and lets them be raised by the world and raised up to destruction, to vessels of dishonor that are going to be destroyed forever. I think what we find in the world around us is people who are wanting to destroy the child in the womb, and then people who are wanting to destroy them if they get out. Destroy them morally. A few years ago, we were on vacation, and we were watching cable, which we don't have at the house, and they had it at this place, so we were watching the Cartoon Network. And it was a cartoon that was clearly meant for small children. Like anybody over the age of 11 would consider it light to medium torture. So, right, this is definitely a small children's cartoon. So we're watching that. And there's nothing offensive in it. Then a commercial comes on. And this commercial is for a cartoon that will come on later that night on the section they call Adult Swim. And it's utterly vulgar. And I'm sitting there watching this commercial, and I thought, who are you showing this commercial? Who do you think's watching this right now? Can I suggest to you they know who's watching it right then? And they have intentions and designs on the people that are watching that right then? And they want to change the minds of children? And can I also suggest to you that maybe even some of those cartoons that you think are utterly innocent are not so innocent. And that there is messaging all along the way to change the moral thought processes of children. And people hand their children over to that. I hear parents say sometimes, well, I just let my children watch the Disney Channel. Oh, well, then they're safe. I'm sure they won't learn anything morally bent from Disney. And I talk to parents who allow their children unfettered access to the internet. They got the devices, and I say, what devices do your children have? And I say, what protections do you have? Oh, well, you know, we trust our children. Well, I trust my children. It's the world I don't trust. And the devil. And I'm going to do everything I can to put some fences up. They're kids. What are you thinking? Throw them to the wolves? Let the world raise them? No, we need to protect them. And what we need to protect them from, I think, is two twistings of what God wants. In Mark chapter 10 and verse 15, Jesus speaks of children. He says, the kingdom is made of these. You got to become like little children. But then, over in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 14, Paul says it's time to stop being children. So that's kind of weird. Jesus says, be like children if you want to be in the kingdom. Paul says, stop being children. So what's going on? Well, of course, what we've got is some good qualities in children. Innocence, naivete, and a loyalty and a faithfulness. There's just a beauty and an honesty among children. And what the world is doing is destroying that as quickly as possible. And so when people say, well, kids are just growing up faster than they ever did. Yeah, but not in any of the good ways. Right? In all the ways we don't want. They're getting cynical sooner. They're seeing things and they're knowing things that, you know, a while back I was reading an article about this guy who was head of sex education on the national level, the curriculum. And he was talking about the things that he wanted to make sure children knew. And he said, well, somebody's got to teach them, you know, at some point. And I read down through the things that I was like, I don't even want to know what that is. What do you mean somebody's got? I hope nobody tells my children or me. I don't even want to look this up. What does that mean? And so they're robbing them of all the innocence and all the purity that Jesus says that's what we want. But I'll tell you the other thing that they're doing. They're keeping them, children, in all the wrong ways. In the ways that Paul says they got to grow up and get some responsibility. That is the way that the world is keeping them, children. And so when people say they're growing up faster than they ever did, yes, in some ways. And in the other way, they're never growing up at all. Because the world tells them they don't have to have responsibility. And it tells them it's not their fault. And they shouldn't have to work hard and scrape. And they shouldn't have to suffer and learn to overcome obstacles. Everything should be handed on a silver platter. What do we got to do? We got to keep them from all that. We got to keep them from all those influences. They didn't just protect Moses from Pharaoh's edict. They protected Moses from all the moral deprivations of Egypt. And we see that. We see that because when it came to the decision point, he has been raised in such a way that instead of taking part in all the pleasures that Egypt had to offer, the Hebrew writer says he chose rather to suffer affliction with God's people. You don't make that decision without having good instruction. Well, I think then of the way that they went about making decisions as they raised Moses. I think about the decisions they had to make and how far that would be from normal decisions you would make. Right, so you get a plan when you're going to have children, and I feel like a lot of people do this. We did this. We talked to people, and we tried to figure out exactly how things were going to go. I've got some friends who've had their first child recently, and we just thought it was so comical because she said, "Oh, it's not his feeding time yet," and I'm like, "It sounds like it is. You know, I mean, it's his feeding time. You know, it's not his nap time yet." Pretty sure he disagrees, you know. So she was going to do it by the book, right? Yeah, you get all that plan, and then they get here, and you deal with it. Well, think about the plans of Moses' parents. And Moses gets here. So what's the plan? Would you ever tell someone, I tell you what, when your baby gets here, hide it from everybody, don't tell anybody. No, that doesn't seem like the thing we do generally with children. It doesn't seem like advice that we would give. We generally celebrate that. But that's what they had to do. Why? It was the best thing at the moment. Right? They don't have the option of sending out the birth announcements. They got to go hide him. Would you ever tell someone, I tell you what, when your baby gets here, got a plan. Make a basket. Be sure it's waterproof, tar it, pitch it. Then just put him in the lake, walk away and see what happens. Seemed like a good plan. No, it's ridiculous. It's a crazy plan. But it's the only available option right now. I got to protect this baby. And here's the thing I can do to protect the baby. And so they do that and they step back and they do see what happens. And then Pharaoh's daughter has the baby, and by providence there is Moses' sister, and she tells her to go get a nursemaid from among the Hebrew women. She goes and gets Moses' mother, who comes up. And do you think that she wants to raise Moses as a surrogate mother? No, that's not the way she wants to raise Moses. Don't you know the thing she'd rather say to Pharaoh's daughter is, that's my child, How dare you ask me to be his nursemaid? But she goes and she raises him as a nursemaid. Because that's the best thing, to protect that child and to raise him in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. It's the best chance he's got. And so that's what she goes and she does. I think sometimes we get plans about what we want for our children, and we set those plans up, and when it doesn't work out, we don't know what to do. It's disaster. Let me just tell you what. You do what's the best available option. And can I also suggest to you that you are the one who has the most influence and control over how your child is raised. There are people who think that their children are going to be raised right if they could only get them into the best school. And then the job situation doesn't work out and we don't have the money to get them into that school. Now what? Well, I guess they're going to be lost. They won't be able to learn anything because they didn't get into that school. Or they want them to live in this neighborhood, or they want them to be a part of this church. And then the children come along and the church that they wanted to be a part of, they've strayed. They're not teaching the truth anymore. Or job situation changes and you're in some town with 30 people or less in the church. I tell you what, if there's not at least 100 people in the church and a good solid youth group, we can't raise faithful children. We've got to have programs, right? We need programs to raise faithful children. They've got to be in Little League, or they're not going to be well adjusted. And so we got to run all over them. We got to turn our whole lives upside down to make sure that they're at practice every night. Because what will happen to them if they can't throw a curveball? And we get all these expectations, and instead of trying to figure out what is best for my child right now in this moment, and what is best eternally for that child, that's where our mindset needs to be. Over in Luke chapter 1, we see the raising of John the Baptist. We see the promise of John the Baptist. John the Baptist is born. And it tells us at the end of that chapter, the child continued to grow and to become strong in spirit, and he lived in the deserts until the day of his public appearance to Israel. I bet he had a lot of friends in the desert. I bet he had a good community in the desert. Lots of programs, after school basketball in the desert. I don't suppose he had much beyond his parents in the desert. But it tells us that he was able to grow and become strong in spirit. And that even though he's out there and he's isolated, he doesn't have all the things that we think we need to raise godly children, here they're able to raise a godly young man. We're going to talk more about that thought and that process on Wednesday night as we talk about Timothy and his inherited faith. But here's what I want you to understand. People say, it takes a village. You've heard that. Maybe there's a book by that title. Listen, villages can be helpful. They can also be terrible. But I tell you what, whether they're helpful or detrimental, it will not make one difference if you are not raising your children. It takes godly parents to raise a child. That's what it takes. And some people think if I send them to public school, that's going to be the answer because then they'll be well adjusted. When people tell me that, I think, have you been to a middle school lately? I mean, is that what you want your children to pattern? You know, but no, that's not going to be the answer. So then people say, well, then I'm going to go to a private school because I want them to be away from the worldliness. Worldliness is there too. So people say, well, I'm going to homeschool them. Well, guess what? Some of the most arrogant and spiritually immature people I have known have grown up in homes where their parents educated them at home and made them think they were better than everybody else in the world. And so the devil's there too. And yet I have known godly, righteous people who were sent to public school. I have known godly and righteous people sent to private school. And I've known godly and righteous people who are schooled at home. But the thing that they all have in common is godly parents. And so it's not the education choices, it's not those life environment choices that you make for your children that are going to make or break. I do believe those things can help and they can harm, but ultimately it is going to be you and your influence. And I believe it is the influence of Jochebed that raises Moses up to know who God is and what is right and what is wrong. Again, when we pray, God, give me faithful children. You know, it's sort of like what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 11 when he's teaching people to pray and he says, give us this day our daily bread. But then over in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 10, Paul says that if a man shall not work, neither shall he eat. Well, which is it? Do we pray for the bread or do we work for it? Yes. And when it comes to raising your children, that's what you do. You pray and you work and you pray and you work and you do both every single day. And even when the circumstances are so much less than ideal, you're not raising them where you want to raise them. You're not raising them with the income you want to raise them on. You're not raising them with the environment, but you're raising them with this. God says, this is what you need. And the rest is variable. This is what you need. And so I hope that you have that kind of confidence going forward, that kind of faith as you raise your children in a world that certainly is wicked, but no more wicked than the world that Moses was raised in. So don't let the world define the value of children for you. Don't lose sight of what our job is, our primary goal as caretakers of souls. That's what we are as parents, caretakers of souls. And no matter what your circumstances are, you decide to follow God. And whether you're a parent or not, I hope that you would make that decision this very evening. Circumstances will never be more favorable. There are people that wait for the stars to align to have children. There are people who wait for the stars to align to obey God. Guess what? They never line up. You just got to make a decision one day, even in the midst of chaos, and say, today I will serve God. And you can do it even in the worst of circumstances in the world. We would rejoice with you if you'd make that decision tonight. If we can help you in any way, won't you come forward while we stand and while we sing?